Are we a nation in ashes? Can the national dialogue help solve our problems, or is it yet another desperate throw of the dice in the hope for the best? On paper, the roadmap is straightforward. 6 to 8 months of ward and sector dialogues, a steering committee to standardize processes and publish summaries, and a second convention in early 2026 to consolidate the outcomes. To help us understand the nuances, outcomes, and what really went down at the first national convention, this week we're joined by Matlala Setlulogile, a political analyst, Xolelwa Kashe Katie, project leader of the Indlulamithi SA Scenarios, and Leslie Tikane, urban sociologist and author of South African Development Perspectives in Question. Thank you very much, lady and gentlemen, for joining us today. I think the buzzword, everybody in the country is at least talking about this national dialogue. And I'm so pleased that you were able to come in and share your insights, share your knowledge, share your experience, having been there on the day and in and around the conversation that is happening around where we are as a country and where we are going or where we are being led to or not led to. So let's start with you because you were there for part of the dialogue. What was your sense of how it worked, if it worked, or what went down on the day? Some of us were watching on the stream. Some of us were watching on TikTok and X. And at points, it looked quite chaotic. It looked quite disorganized. And at points, it actually also looked like people were listening and engaging and having the conversation. For you in the room, what was your sense?
Pumi, I think my sense, or at least based on my first assessment of the convention, it actually set the pace for a dialogue that does not necessarily have any intellectual vision. To what end are we initiating the national dialogue? Because it can't be a dialogue for the sake of having a dialogue. There must be an end goal in mind. And I think we need to make a distinction between a national dialogue and a public consultation process. Is this a national dialogue in a true sense or a public consultation process by government? And I think those are some of the questions that one actually asks themselves. And also, you mentioned the chaos that ensued on the first day. I mean, the chaotic nature of those 2 days over the weekend kind of sums up the lack of planning and the lack of intellectual clarity behind the planned national dialogue. Mm. Yeah.
Chaos. Is it necessary? Is it necessary? That's why we have a scenario planner as well. And that's why we have a sociologist with us in the room. Is it necessary? Should we be having this conversation in this way? What do you think?
Well, as part of our work, we have been advocates for a national dialogue because this is not just an idea that came out or came up with any particular individual. This is something that was part of our project of transition in 1994 because it was understood that when CODESA happened and elections took place, there was a TRC and the constitution-making process, but there was so much contestation there, and there was this idea of sufficient consensus. So the idea was to continue with dialoguing so that we can find each other because we're coming from this wounded past. Then they wrote it into law and put it within an institution that this institution is supposed to drive a dialogue on an annual basis, starting in 1995, and that was the NEDLAC, through the NEDLAC Act. Mm. That did not happen. Instead, NEDLAC evolved to become a bargaining council where labor and organized business became very dominant. So this did not happen, and administration after administration, they did not pay attention to that. And some might think, okay, maybe because the ANC lost an election in 2024, this is when they realized that maybe it's a desperate move.
Well, I mean, if I think about it and think back at it, this iteration of what it is and come to you is actually seeming to us on the outside as this is definitely when Thabo Mbeki came out and said last year, even before the elections, we need to have a reconfiguration and a dialogue and what, and now here we are. So it seems like that's why we see it that way.
South Africans are not stupid. We know what happened. And so if now you're going to see this happening, and also there's also this idea that it could be a ploy to campaign for next year's local government elections. So there is a need for citizens to actually take over or take charge of this dialogue and not leave the state to lead it, because otherwise we will go down that deep dark hole.
Leave the state to lead it.
I'm not going to answer that question. I've got a couple of issues that I just want to raise, right? And I'm going to hold my line.
Yeah.
And then you can respond to me in that. Let's engage in this debate in that way, right? First of all, I think it was an idea paved with good intention but failed, right? Why am I saying that? From the beginning, and this is the second interview I'm doing on the convention. Prior to the convention, I was on ENCA. I said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. There was no content for the convention before the conference could take place. Mm-hmm. So when you go for interviews, you do research, you prepare yourself like I did for you here.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find any content except key objectives. One, nation formation, poverty, inequality, patronage. These are things that we've been talking about over years. We sound like scratch records now.
We are having this dialogue as South Africans.
So that's the first problem I have with it, right? Then the second thing I think that was a confusion is that people tend to confuse a policy-creating platform and a convention. A convention is a talk shop. It is a talk shop. Then that raises the question, do we need to talk or not? As Colonel has alluded earlier on, we had a conference on nation formation, social cohesion, which was by the state, and so on and so on. For me, I think what is important in answering that question is that we need to talk. There's nothing wrong with talking. We have to talk. We don't have to sometimes be able to create or recreate policy, but we need to talk and vent our anger, but also be able to say to the state, this is how we want you to shift or change implementation of policies and so on. In fact, this to me, I always say that this type of conventions are an episode with no end.
But Matlala, this sounds very much like what Matlala is saying. Matlala, you are saying this is just a talk shop, and you know, is it public consultation? But the talking, you know, I mean, there are some words that I keep hearing said over and over. It must be citizen led. Kulela, you also spoke about that. It must be citizen led. It mustn't be government led. It's not it's not owned in this way. And I agree. I think as Africans, talking is one of the things that we do quite well. Consultation is one of the things that we do very well. But is this the form that this thing should be taking? Is it, you know, is it a political ploy? In your view, is it a political ploy? Do we have a president who has no ideas, who has no way of inspiring us, and therefore is trying to co-opt something that people may want, people will participate in, to save his skin?
I think just to hop on what Leslie said first, he spoke about people venting. I think the best way to sum it up is a national venting session.
Yeah. Was it, though, a national venting session?
But remember, it was just a convention. There's still a planned roadmap. There's going to be dialogue, society dialogue, what dialogues, consolidation of those different perspectives throughout the process, because the dialogue runs for over a year, if I'm not mistaken. Was it a ploy? The first important thing, I think Kola spoke about it, some people on the optic say that just because the ANC, you know, lost elections and all of it. I'm one of those people who share that specific view, and I think I have done a public opinion piece on that party crisis is not a South African crisis. We live in a multi-party democracy, first and foremost. The expectation that there should be consensus on every issue is misplaced. Part of a multi-party and multicultural, to be quite important, I think, emphasize on the multicultural aspect of our society. Conflict exists. It's not the absence of conflict that denotes peace. Conflict in itself exists in all societies. And I think ours is a panic in terms of How do we manage this inability that the former governing party has lost to aggregate all this different or plethora of societal interests under one umbrella? So I think there's a bit of panic in terms of that aspect in society. It's just teething problems for a coalition government-based future in the South African political landscape. I think, in fact, for people to actually say the crisis started in 2024 elections, they were late. Nah. You'd remember that we've had several hung municipalities since 2021. In fact, 2016, to be quite frank, where there was over, what, I think in 2021, there was over 60 hung councils around the country.
Well, if you talk about a venting session, if there's one thing South Africans know how to do is to vent, they're burning tires. They're just last week, Germiston Home Affairs was sick. There's always all of these ways within which our communities are bursting out at what they see as non-delivery, at disappointment in a government. So is this the kind of venting session that we need, or is this just like we're spending money to vent on something that could be maintained in a different way?
I think we need to vent, because remember, I mean, it's 30 years on and there's so much anger. I mean, if you were to look closely at the Indlamiti scenarios, we speak of that. We've got a Hadida nation that is a very noisy democracy where we're constantly bickering, finger-pointing, blaming each other, blaming the blacks, blaming the whites, blaming the past, blaming apartheid, blaming the foreigners. But it's a very loud democracy. You see how it unfolds in parliament. And that's something that was written in those scenarios. For example, when I arrived at that convention on day one, I was so disappointed by the size of the protest outside. I imagined there was going to be this massive pushback, because that's who we are. We allowed, there's so much contestation. And even inside the room, what was encouraging is how people demanded to be given the space, to a point where the facilitators just could not. They had to allow all those angry voices to vent and vent. And that's why it became a venting session, because psychologically, if you've been suppressed for so long and feeling unheard, you end up burning tires. And that's what we saw in the last scenarios, which we ended up in the Gwara Gwara scenario, where we just protest after protest and we keep naming them service delivery, xenophobic attacks. Meanwhile, it's this anger and all these ruptures started. We've been tracing them from FISMAS 4. You go into the July 2021. But it's that anger. So it's not surprising. And it has to be allowed for us to find each other, or maybe eventually find healing.
This a nation forming, though? Is this a nation that is a nation of very different types of people forming and norming and storming?
No, let's address two things. I think the venting part, we need it. That's what civil society should be. We don't need a dominant civil society. We want a vibrant civil society, right? Otherwise, you're going to become like Eastern Europe. You see, in Russia, there, no civil society, nothing. We need that civil society. We need to keep it on. It must be, as I said earlier, on an episode with no end. Because all these struggles are not struggles. The gender struggle is not something you're going to have a convention and finish it and resolve it there. And that's why I'm saying this was a convention. They said it was a convention. They didn't say we're coming to create policy. I think in the public discourse and the people we're communicating there, we're communicating wrongly to the public, right? Because people go there with expectations of we're going to go and have a peer policy or that. No, it's not. Convention, if you read convention, in literal in English, the convention is so tetapa, kichi umtrim, sorry.
But the communication.
Just a second point I want to raise around the issue. The question that you are raising about political party or not, it doesn't matter which party. It doesn't matter, ANC or DA, whichever party that is there. But any political party or the state, actually, because this issue raises state and party relations, right? The ANC is a ruling party. It is a governing party. The point of who's controlling this convention, the state must control the convention. The state must intervene in society. We cannot have a toothless state that is not able to intervene in society. And intervention doesn't mean only in terms of economic terms. Intervention also means socially, culturally creating these dialogues.
Mm.
That in itself is a form of intervention. That is where my point of departure is on the issue.
But is it okay?
Just to come in on something, in terms of what Leslie said. Firstly, let me hop on to the last point. State intervention, right? Kolelwa said something about citizen-led. Who amongst the citizens leads?
Well,
because I'll make this very point, because there's this notion, I think you mentioned a dormant civil society. There's this notion that civil society in its very nature is a true representative of society, which is not necessarily the case, because in the past few years, we have seen the emergence of what one could refer to a civil society elite. Elites within civil societies and groupings of civil societies that are elitist groups as well. How do those connect with society? How do they connect with the layman on the ground? And I say this because even part of the organizing committee of the National Convention and by default the National Dialogue are very elitist civil society organizations that are taking part.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So who amongst the citizens is going to lead? Those are some of the questions.
I think there's also a debate around who civil society is, because you will remember when the foundations pulled out, there was also this debate on whether they truly represent civil society, and that's what they seemed to be calling for. And and you've got a valid point about how civil society has now morphed into, you know, to form part of the political elite, actually. So there is that proximity. However, I think part of the challenge with communication had to do with precisely that, in terms of who's in the room and who's outside. And that could not be resolved until literally 24 hours before the convention. Hence the chaos.
But okay.
I just want to carry on this. Because remember, the foundations pulled out a week before.
The legacy foundations.
Yes. And then there's this civil society that stepped in. And I think through that, there was an ability to open up the space a bit more. I truly did not even believe that I was going to be in the room, even though we wrote the scenarios and I'm the project leader of scenarios, until the very last minute. And it was through those very civil society organizations, because there was a caucus by civil society to actually be on the streets. There was a massive caucus that's been going on since April. And then everybody there agreed that we need a dialogue, as we are all agreeing here. However, when that fallout happened, there was this idea that if there was still debate, but there was this idea that if we allow it to collapse, then you can never come back and say, let's dialogue again, because it will lose legitimacy. So I think the optics of it and the conflict and the contestation, that's what unfolded, especially on day one, where you could see that there's a level of chaos because everybody stepped in on the last 2 days, I think.
Beverly did you all this time, but Leslie, I want to hear you, and then I have a question about civil society.
Yeah, no, I'm actually addressing civil society. I think we need to redefine civil society. We need to redefine civil society, because in redefining civil society, we have to admit that in South Africa, we live in a post-colonial state. Right? There's a tendency of assuming that we are still in the old apartheid state. We are no longer in the post-colonial state. We have to admit that we have a democratic government. There were democratic elections in South Africa, right? Now, let's see how civil society interact with the post-colonial state, right? How does civil society interact with the post-colonial state? It's a very important question to ask, right? In how it does so, we need to ask, what is civil society?
Right? And what's the authority?
And it's what I call, I use this analogy, yeah, to say that we have what we call now a carbon crook analysis, right? Bad state, good civil society. It's not true.
Which is not necessarily
it's
the
not
case.
True. You cannot say bad state, good civil society. Civil society itself is bad. Ezi Dimeni was civil society. They were corrupt. They killed people, those people. They were civil society groups. Now they come in.
The authority, but right? So equally, when you look at civil society organizations like Dudula, when you look at those kinds of actors, What is the authority on which they act in these ways?
That's why we have to redefine it. We cannot say good state, bad. We need to be act-oriented, right? We need to analyze these groups from a specific point of view, right? Who in the state is bad? Because there are bad people in the state, definitely. But there are some good people too. In civil society, equally, we must say, who is bad there? Because there are bad people. This assumption of a homogeneous civil society that is good, right? We need to heterogenize in our analysis, our analytical framework, theoretical framework, conceptual framework on these two things must be based on those.
Yeah,
right?
On exactly that. I will tell you because, one of the things.
Also, the other thing is business. You know, there are three relations here. Business as well. I mean, business is not good business all the time. A lot of corrupt people, their capital is corrupt.
So this right? is the thing about
and
net
the eminent groups.
This is the thing about
the
group
of the conference was having some of these elites there.
But I'm really, one of the things that it's nice, ne? We're in this room, we're having these deep, thoughtful conversations, these big words, and you know, and there's something to be said about the even just the meaning and the etymology of some of these things.
Yes.
But in South Africa today, if I am a 18-year-old sitting at Dandi with no prospects for work, with a bad matric result, with no way of getting to university, yonke lento, all of this, what does that mean for that kid? Mm-hmm. You know, if I look at the fact that the median age in South Africa is 27, undereducated, with very few prospects, in an incredibly terrible economy, what does this do for them? This whole conversation, is it, what, and then what?
I think the inequality that is actually has taken us to where we are, that's what our research found, that we are not finding each other, we're not realizing social cohesion because we are so unequal. But then it's not just in terms of material means. It's not just about income inequality. It's inequality precisely how you're describing it. That young black woman from Umkanduli who has no chance of having their voice heard. And as a result of this, and you find this across the spectrum. So even with civil society, that inequality exists. The inequality also exists within business sector. So you'd find that in a platform like NEDLAC now, where they are supposed to be doing the dialoguing since 1995. Big business is represented there. But when you look at our economy, there's the informal sector that does not find expression there. Another form of inequality. Civil society itself, because civil society got so eroded post-apartheid, I don't know if it's whether because there was fatigue from activism throughout the 80s and 90s that civil society stepped back. I mean, there was Sangoko back in the days, which used to organize civil society.
I never heard that word in there.
Exactly. And those were the organizing. We had strong civil society. Actually, civil society was behind even the mass democratic movement for us to actually, they contributed immensely to our freedom. But as soon as freedom came, something happened within civil society. Others got co-opted into the state. And there was also lack of funding because there was this idea that Mandela's dream has been realized and therefore there's no need to support these movements. Even though they're supposed to have a seat at the table at NEDLAC, they don't have enough of a voice there because they've been completely eroded. They're not supported.
Matlala, I want to ask you.
To interject, I think, I can't remember if it was Raymond Sattner. He captures the issue quite well. When he talks about what happens to civil society post-94, that there was this, the government will provide mindset. So there was never, well, people or civil society never saw a need to keep being active. Only then, when the failures of the new democratic dispensation came to the fore, that's when now civil society started reorganizing in the South African context. But I think it has a lot to do with messaging. Talking on the issue of messaging, Leslie mentioned something very important, that the convention is just there to talk and vent. But when you listen into the keynote, the messaging from the president was not necessarily that. And I think that's what matters in setting the tone for the convention and the upcoming dialogue, the entire process. He said South Africa is here, to renew itself. The notes, I don't have my notes, but I made notes as he made his input. his keynote was not necessarily we're here to vent. It's we're here to find solutions. And even some of the inputs were, to be quite fair and honest, sorry for the language, but it was dumb. We need to ask why are South Africans still living in poverty?
Yes, his keynote government. Was the worst thing I've heard because why is our president setting a tone that says we need to ask ourselves why there is this inequality? Why he's the leader. He's like the top dog. Why is this the question? And this is my question that I wanted to ask you from a political point of view. Mm-hmm. This positioning, now that he is there now, you know, his eminent persons are there. And clearly, government has taken this role and this step of being the lead voice in this conversation. Do you think there's a political will to solve any of these problems?
In fact, to be quite honest, I think one of the things that government is hoping to achieve with this is just kicking the can down the road, because currently they do not necessarily have, you know, the solutions to South Africa's burning issues. In fact, funny enough, at the convention, I think on Friday, I was sitting next to a friend. We had this conversation and we looked at Cyril as he was giving the input. And we said, potentially, he is South Africa's biggest political risk because of his poor leadership or lack of or absence of leadership. In fact, the distemper that is prevalent in our society is anchored in lack of leadership. So political will is something that we know is quite absent in the South African society or South African political class. And not just the political class. I think it was Tolelwa, Leslie touched on civil society, touched on business. The leadership class, its entirety, we have a proper leadership deficiency in this country. And that's why issues such as the convention materializes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we also identified in, as a key driver, leadership. The same way that we found that inequality is nuanced, it's across all, you know, categories, leadership as well, because we have this tendency of pointing to the state when we think about leadership deficiencies. But you look at our churches, you look at our street committees, you look at our families. There's no leadership within our own homes. So there is this thing that's quite endemic in our society that needs to be dealt with. And now if they want to attain a compact, because that's supposed to be the idea, the end game, this whole dialogue after a year, it's supposed to lead to that. To realize a social compact, you need strong leadership. That's what the Asian Tigers did, and that's what we're modeling this idea on, that we want to be like Singapore. We've looked at Ireland, we've looked at Australia, we've looked at how other countries have managed to forge a social compact. But a key ingredient is strong, decisive leadership.
So the thing about strategy...
Just to add, Leslie said at the end of the convention and the dialogue, it's not a matter of policy, right? Mm. Social compacting essentially leads is the foundation of policy. So the way government has framed it is that there must be solution to our issues.
I want to talk a little bit more around this political risk issue. So you respond to that, and I'll come back to it.
When I said that they don't understand the word convention, I didn't mean the public only. It looks like the state actors also don't understand the word convention. They're very correct.
Because they're not capable.
And then also there's another point. Why do we have eminent
group?
It sounds very elitist. I mean, how does that language translate to ordinary people? Oh, there's eminences there. And these eminences, they are the loudest. And I know some of them. They're not very clever.
It's an elite project.
I mean, I'm really sorry. I've seen them. I've met them before. Abafundi.
But to be quite fair on that, Leslie, do all people within the eminent persons group need to be these intellectuals or whatever? Isn't that supposed to be a representation or a macrocosm of society? I mean, we talked about the chaos, right? That unfolded over the 2 days there. Sometimes you actually question a number of things that are happening, but you remember that this is a national convention that's supposed to be inclusive. it doesn't matter what people's intellectual capabilities or capacities are, what their standing in society is, whether they contribute in thought leadership.
But the minute you say these ones are eminent persons,
you've elevated them. The minute you say
these ones, this list of 65 people.
In their sector.
They should have come from the communities.
Yeah. In their sectors, not necessarily. Because remember, there's different sectors represented. The criteria, whether it's intellectual capability, that's something that I don't think is the case.
I think the flaw was starting with the eminent persons, and that was a good move, especially if you are a government that is dealing with...
The flaw was a good move, is that what you said?
It was a good move, that flaw, because then it opened up for contestation. From that moment, the moment the eminent persons were announced, there was a lot of noise questioning the process. Mm-hmm. And now, what you're seeing, this attempt at the steering committee that has still not been formed, mm-hmm. is an attempt to at least make sure that the sectors that were represented, they can nominate people. And then those are supposed to be the actual... you know, foot soldiers of the national dialogue. Those eminent persons, from what I read, it was they're supposed to be mascots of sorts, but like ambassadors, you know, the face of the thing, but not really the people who are providing the direction. The direction is supposed to come from the sectors. But even that, it should have started with the communities before it gets to that elitist a platform. A but it started approach. There. It started and from
Leslie,
the top.
Leslie is dying to I'm say dying. Something. Dying.
I'm just angry they didn't make me elitist as well. You know what I mean? but anyway, I want to draw a nice contrast here, you see, because this is very important. Right? Because we're not just harping on this elitist thing, right? You know, in this country, in the 80s, I don't know how old you guys were at that time, the United Democratic Front was started. Mm-hmm. It was not started by elitist people. They didn't put that. You had Oscar Mbetu from Cape Town, who was an ordinary worker from Guguletu. Mm-hmm. You had rural people, right? Mm-hmm. You had people from Venda, what is this guy, Nefutalu, the bishops there from Venda, traveling by bus, by taxi, right? To go to Cape Town with ordinary people. I mean, there's a story I was laughing 2 weeks ago with a friend of mine. He said, one old man had a whole basket of a chicken, you know, and he was sharing this chicken in the taxi with people. It was Mkhatshwa and them, all these people. It was not this elitist, eminent group.
Peter Maritzburg, there was right? DC
it was organic, you know. So that's the point we're making here. We're not saying... And the elite, the eminent persons group themselves should have had the conscience to be able to say, Andy, I'm not going there. Mm-hmm. This thing doesn't suit. We've got a tendency of not saying no.
Mm-hmm. Or
when you cannot do things, or when things are bad and you are there, you just, no. You must be able to have the consciousness of being able to say, I can't drive a car. I can't, I have no license. Don't take the car and drive it. Gonna kill yourself. Say, I don't know how to drive a car.
So, okay, so there is also quite a lot of navel gazing happening here, right? And you raise the issue of the political risk of not having a strong leader in our president. And I want to open it up a little bit more to say, well, you know, in scenarios and in strategy, you also have to think about the environment when you come up with these things, these plans and these conversations. And the environment that we are operating in is a very unstable Washington, mm-hmm. as it were, right? And you talk about this political risk. Do you think that all of these various things are looking at South Africa and who we are and how the world is seeing us and dynamic and responsive as well? Or are we just, as Nanda, as Valumnyango, we're having a family meeting? Does it matter?
I think the notion that countries or democracies across the globe are quite stable, no conflict, no internal issues, tends to be misplaced. I think the most important thing, that's why when I touched on the issue of multi-party democracy, just managing the transition or the evolution of political landscape, we just have to find a way to manage our issues better, literally. And I think Leslie spoke about people burning tires, I think, earlier. That is a form of political expression, and that's a form of political participation. One can even, you know, intimate that the convention and the subsequent dialogue are a way of actually, how does even one, you know, phrase this, containing the expression of people and controlling the trajectory of that anger rather than letting it out there. And I think that's where the convention and the subsequent dialogue have, you know, lost a bit of credibility. Is it genuine? Aimed at solving this issues. But bottom line to your question, Pumi, internal conflicts in every society are ever present. There's no single society. I mean, even advanced economies that are considered the most democratic society. Before we went on air, you were speaking about the USA. There's daily protests. There's
French farmers throwing manure.
The French are considered the birthplace of democracy.
Hey, but they invented protest.
So issues like that is not an issue. How you manage and actually channel those energies towards the solutions, that's what matters.
So what's the you know, being a girl wearing high heels will teach you that sometimes the thing that makes you incapable of withstanding pressures is because your shoe is tight.
Mm-hmm.
Are we not talking about the tight shoe that South Africans are in, which is the economy? Mm-hmm. I mean, prior to our now consistently declining economy, we had less protests because people were making enough to survive. People were living and had prospects. This economy that's, shall we say, very slowly growing at 0.6% is a tight, tight shoe. What does that mean for our society? And I'm going to look at Leslie, as a... For me, it's a social question.
Yeah,
issue,
no, I think
right?
These questions
the
are...
tight shoe.
No, I like you asking that question because these questions are interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
They are not disconnected, right?
Yeah.
Because essentially what we're talking about here is democratic pluralism.
Yep.
Now, we are all for democratic pluralism, but democratic pluralism cannot be defined in terms of party, right? The notion of multi-party, okay, I like it. But you can't have multi-party all over. A country like Cuba can have a one-party state because Cuba is as big as Soweto. Yeah. So the notion of when you create parties, whether it's multi-party or it's one-party state, should not be on the basis of ideology. It should be on the basis of praxis. You know, if Cuba, South Africa cannot have a one-party state, it's too big. But Cuba can have, because Cuba is almost as big as Soweto. Do you think you want too many mayors in Soweto? Ambi was enough. Amos was on the whoever is covering Soweto now.
Like it wasn't enough.
So there's that. But therefore then, and also what you're saying, we've got a plethora of them. Like, for example, in America, you can critique too, because it's a limited, you only have two choices. Either you're a Democrat or you're a Republican, which is
or
a rubbish. It's a worst form
or
of democracy.
Or you're Bernie Sanders.
It's a worst form of democracy, America's one, really. And they are the first one to point to us. But the point is that all these things, as I said, are not disconnected. Mm-hmm. They are connected. Mm-hmm. The question of economy contributes in one way or another to the vibrancy or non-vibrancy of a society. You see?
Mm-hmm.
Because if economy is not functioning, for example, in the convention, people were making this comment that, it's taxpayers' money, But we do agree that this is a democratic process that must take place. Democratic processes all over the world are expensive. Even we know in our own elections here, elections cost a lot of money.
Billions.
Some countries cannot afford to have these elections because they don't have the resources. So when this question was raised that, too much, I said, no, this is a logistical question. It's not important. Because then you negate yourself. You are saying that democratic processes must not take place because we do not. If we have the resources, we're able to. Let's do it. Right? If wherever the money comes from, the point is that we need to caution. Don't buy too much into the coffin of the taxpayer. That would be something that we can caution. But the fact that we sometimes, when we can afford these processes, so I agree with our caution about how much money, but it must be balanced with the fact that can we afford, can we not afford? If we raise that question in that way, then I understand.
Okay.
I just want to build on the economy one. You know, and I agree with Leslie that it's not just the economy, like that tight shoe. Like our research has found that also there's these security threats that we have, and we know it. We don't feel as secure as we should be. And because we are so unequal, if you are in the middle class or someone who happens to be in this room, you can get your ADT because you cannot trust the cops to come to your rescue. And then you find the poor, then, you know, leaning towards vigilantism. And then us in the ivory towers then look down on them, you know, when they start protesting or when they form their own forums. Because, again, even there, the police will not go there. So if you you have the means, you can buy security, you can buy education, you can buy health. But then we're leaving so many people behind, and that's the majority. And then that also leads to this insecurity. And the security threats are not only internal. And the internal ones are the youth that are idle there. And they're the majority, and the majority of which are unemployed. And then you combine that toxic mix with a state that is not capable to lead, then all those three combined are taking us to what we've named a vulture culture, which is really a gangster state, wherein you've got criminal syndicates running the country. Unless we move towards the other scenario, wherein you find this strengthening of civil society doing something that's similar to what the UDF did in the 90s to take the country forward. Starting from the 80s into the 90s. But we see something like that also happening, that rupture. So it's either you're going to have this gangster state where these criminal syndicates are running the show and providing the services that the state is supposed to provide, or we carry on like the Hardy does, just making noise and bickering endlessly with no end goal. Or we're going to have this rupture, this popular uprising. I mean, when we're doing interviews, the word revolution kept on coming up so many times, and especially from the young people. So that's where we're going. And if we don't dialogue, that's what we're going to find. All those mini ruptures are going to be combined into this rupture.
A big rupture.
Exactly.
Leslie, I'm going to come to you and then I'm going to finish with you. Is that okay?
Yeah, I just want to. But it's fine.
You know, No, you'll forget.
I want to sum it up.
Okay,
right? Some of these issues raise questions of normativity. You see? Right. Let me start with this. Is it different social actors in society, when faced by difficult conditions, act rationally and irrationally?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They create all sorts of survival strategies and means of surviving. Therefore, this act rationally and irrationally. That's why we have crime, all these things and so on. Because different people with agency, therefore, then act in that way. They try to find strategies of how to get through this. That's why I'm saying often when people say, pose the question, corruption in South Africa, I say it's a very normative question. A lady who steals an egg in Rosebank from my bag, I just give her that egg. I won't take her to the police station, you know, because she's acting, she's hungry. I should be able to see that, right? But the Guptas, yeah. So this question becomes normative.
Mm.
You know, it's like, I forget this woman in there. So I forgot the book now. Yeah, Rose Ackerman says, you know, if I was a Jew in a concentration camp, I'll do anything to survive, to get there. I will steal, I will do. And that's what I believe. And that's what we are faced with.
Mm.
You see. So these questions are, that's why I'm saying they are normative questions, and we've got to find a theoretical way of being able to analyze them and think them through in that way. So that question you raised is very important. That's why I'm saying it's not disconnected. They are interconnections, and we must be able to see those interconnections that exist within these issues.
I think that's so. You get the last word, Dr. Matlala.
I think Golala mentioned something very important about, you know, if we don't have this dialogues, the distemper is going to flare up and all of that. But I think in all of this, linking it to the economy as well, the economy question, what necessitates the dialogue? I think that should be the question. What necessitates it? You know, in governance terms, especially when we look at the state and all of that, there's a notion of state strength, which is state capabilities, essentially. We have a state that can't do the most mundane and basic things that, to be quite honest, we've had this conversation for years. In fact, I think this is the second decade we're having this conversation about the ability of government just to deliver even the most basic of things. By the way, in as much as these economic conceptions might sound too complex or whatever, it doesn't take much to ignite economy of any country. Provide the basic services, provide security, provide social infrastructure. These are not rocket science issues.
And education, so we have the skills.
So, yeah, I think the economy question boils down to the failures of the state. It doesn't matter, as Leslie correctly points out, in my view, that all of these are interconnected. We spoke about poor leadership, the president being the number one political risk in the country, the inability of the states to do the most, you know, the most basic of things. Until the state can actually do the most basic of things, we're going to have endless conventions and dialogues. We can dialogue as much as we want, as long as we do not solve the issues that confound our society. We're going to be back here discussing the same thing in about 5-10 years from now, literally. That's if the tempers don't flare.
That's if we don't have, thank you. Well, thank you so much for helping me think through this, and I hope even for our audience, they feel. So I feel ambivalent after this conversation. At some point, I thought I was agreeing with all of you that we needed this dialogue and that it's going to go somewhere. But I'm suddenly feeling like maybe we're going to be having an endless conversation, and maybe that is what is important. You know, I'm Zulu, and the one thing that I've always known is that izinto zoniwa umlomo. You know, you ruin things with your mouth and what you say, but that's also the only way to fix it, is by having this conversation and working it out. So a part of me feels quite glad that I've had this conversation and am able to now work out a little bit better where we stand with the national dialogue. Thank you. On paper, it sounds like a joke, right? A political analyst, an urban sociologist, and a strategist in a room. But really, for me, these three wonderful South Africans have helped me reorganize my thoughts about what hopes and flaws lie ahead on the roadmap of the national dialogue. And I hope it's done the same for you. Join us again next week.